Friday Afternoon Deploy is still a firm believer in password confirmation fields in your registration forms. You might run into this later.
Oh yeah,
you didn't see the confirmless password registration, or like, good. Then you're not guilty of doing it to the world.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
So yeah. this is some goddamn UX hack. Like, shave 14 seconds off of our registration process, driven by a chief growth officer or something. That now registration forms for web applications have a single password field. Oh, okay. So if you mistype your password, sucks to be you. You're going to have to go through the reset password flow. It drives me insane. It also really trips up password managers that like don't know how to fill the second field or you know.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
They just put it like in your address bar.
So every time I see that, it just it gets to me because someone just threw that away. Someone just looked at it and said, hey, we can reduce this redundant field on the registration form. Totally like just disregarding however many years of like engineering history where we've said like, it's probably a good idea to get a confirmation on the password.
So I use a password manager for everything and I literally just have it generate a password.
Same.
So it's never misspelled.
That's true.
So that's why I don't think I've actually thought about
sometimes
this.
Sometimes maybe my password manager sucks. Maybe one password sucks, but it throws it off sometimes.
There was something where that bit me the other day because I filled out the password and I do that and I did it. But then like there was a screen, I forget what app it was. There was a screen where I had to have the password and then I'm like, but
there can be there's some weirdness sometimes for sure.
I don't know what the password is.
One thing that frustrates me now with most, like as everything seems to turn into, and I called it Selenium last week. I meant, it's not Selenium. It's the web apps that everybody installs now, like Docker and everybody.
Confused.
The platform that you build a JavaScript app.
Node?
For like desktop?
Yeah, for your desktop.
Oh, Electron.
Electron. Yeah. Electron apps. In the last podcast, I called them Selenium apps, but I meant Electron apps.
Oh. Okay.
As everything seems to go towards Electron apps, I see more and more, particularly login pages, that are very obviously like, you just put a web page in that spot. That's not a real element you built in your app. Mm-hmm. You're just being lazy.
It's pretty bad.
And everything's off, like the spinning wheel of we're logging you in is like halfway out of the element and you can't see it because it just iframed in a web login or something.
Well, particularly if that login's like OAuth based because you still have like an OAuth web based login. It also looks really bad when your Electron app at the bottom of it says this page best viewed in Firefox at 768 by or whatever.
Nothing's best viewed in Firefox.
That joke was bad.
I'm a Firefox user and nothing's best.
How do you
viewed
feel about like it's email sad. Confirmation fields though? Yeah, I've seen those.
Well, no, because I mean, like,
you can see it.
Yeah,
it's not blurred out.
It's not ghosted. It's not blurred.
Yeah, well, it doesn't have to be. It's your email. So I mean, so I guess what I'm saying is, I've seen people do this paradigm where you got your registration form, you know, so your email and then your password. There's only one password, but you confirm your email. So then at least you can make sure you get that right so you can reset your password because you're going to get it wrong.
I guess that's why. Yeah. That's wise. If you're going to eliminate the second password confirmation, you better make damn sure that your email is right so that you can go through the reset workflow.
That's a good point.
Yeah.
But it doesn't make it more efficient.
That's still
your email in twice and your password
I saw one
once.
Of those a while back and I thought, huh,
this is still a zero-sum game. Hey, we're back, everybody.
Thus concludes old men complain about what you kids are doing to technology these days.
I don't know that I would confidently conclude that segment yet.
So you mentioning Electron actually made me think of something. So I came across a library the other day in JavaScript, of course. But if you guys
you came across like 2.5 million libraries.
Right. I know that you guys use a lot of Python. So when you guys are scraping websites, if that website requires you to authenticate somehow, how do you guys typically handle that? Do you write code to mirror like the login process?
Or? Whenever I've done that, we would use something like a headless browser and like Selenium WebDriver to do it.
Okay,
for proper scraping, we just let it be a browser. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Either headless Chrome or like Phantom.js when that was a thing.
Okay, yeah. So came across a library the other day called Nightmare.js.
Oh, that sounds familiar.
And
No, I'm just confusing JavaScript with.
please tell me. Please tell me it's spelled with a K. Nightmare.js.
No, but that's about to exist.
Yeah, of course. I'm going to create it after this.
You should. It's just a fork of Nightmare.
Yeah. No changes.
Literally no changes. And you will already get more people.
Right.
Yeah.
Which Nightmare are you using?
Yeah.
The one with a K, obviously.
Obviously. The hipster Nightmare.
Oh, it's got a way better readme.
Yeah. Right. So... it basically runs an Electron app that runs an actual version of Chrome inside the Electron app for when you're scraping websites.
Got it.
And it makes that whole process pretty amazing and easy.
So this is like, you mean like you're scraping, it actually puts an authentication field in front of the user who's scraping, or you mean it does this in a totally headless process?
You can either do it in like a headless process, or you can actually make it show you the browser in the Electron app on the screen and you can watch it scrape.
Got it.
Which is pretty interesting. It's basically because in previous experiences with Node and scraping, we would like basically go through the authentication process, like basically try to just use Node to submit credentials and mirror that process instead of doing it in a headless browser. And so this was pretty amazing and life-changing, honestly.
I guess I have to like see it in context because I'm having a hard time visualizing.
Yeah, I can show you. So I can show you after this.
Yeah, I'm looking at the GitHub of it, which I shared in our
Slack channel. Okay, I'm gonna have to look at it because I believe you. I'm just having a hard time visualizing.
Yeah. So a friend of mine has his own business, and part of that business is he has to write a bunch of reports. And those get published to his clients in HTML, but all of that is behind like his account on this website, right? And he uses a lot of the same phrases in these reports that he writes. And so he was like, I was like, well, what if I just pulled every report you've ever written and categorized everything that you have ever said? And he has another application that kind of helps him create the reports,
right?
And he can just do that and have a drop down where he's just Mad choosing,
Libs.
Right. And so I started to do that, and I did it with this Nightmare.js, and it was pretty nice. I was impressed.
Interesting. We've done a lot of scraping. I've done a lot of work with like Scrapy is a scraping framework in Python, and then also just like I guess it depends on how badly you need to like render JavaScript and stuff,
right? Yeah,
to make it work, because obviously there's the good old HTTP that you can just
Yeah.
Everything's a RESTful API if you just speak HTTP at it.
But
all the Git.
Yeah. There's a lot of web out there that like what you get nowadays is like, cool, here's a Webpack bundle.
Mm. Right.
Good luck. Yeah.
Yeah. I can show you some stuff after this. It was pretty nice.
The old view source ain't what it used to be.
No.
Out of curiosity, can you talk about what you were scraping? I guess you have an example of it. I was wondering if that was more for scraping certain retail data out there, because I've had that problem in the past. Because that shit's all in React. When you're scraping, I can't say the name.
Divs for days.
But old rhymes with Schmalmart. It's very hard to scrape.
Yeah, so it was not for that.
Imagine that's by design.
Yeah.
But partially, it's also by hipster. They got a bunch of those jet.com kids in there.
Oh, that's true. That's right.
Like, let's rewrite the front end 12 times a day.
But the bonus is security through
obscurity.
Obscurity.
For sure.
What that actually did was it had been so long since I had to write JavaScript that directly interacted with the DOM. It was a very humbling experience. It was like, oh, yeah, query selector all. Right. It's been a while. Here we go.
I just had the same thing. I was telling Alan, I just built a prototype app the other day for fun. We talked about, we had our platform as a service episode. That was two episodes ago. And I said, I'm going to try deploying something to Heroku again. So I did, I built something and that shit was way easier than last time I used it. Legit, like up and running within a few minutes with a Django app. So that was cool. But, I just wanted to do some really primitive UI stuff. I was, since this was totally for just for fun, personal project, I decided to like try something new top to bottom. I was like, I'll build a React Native client on it, which that ended up not, I didn't go as far with that as I wanted to, but, I did actually try a different front end CSS framework. So that was fun.
Which one did you use?
I tried UIKit.
I've never used that one.
Yeah. I went through a bunch. It wasn't my top pick from like a, design and usability standpoint, but I was looking for something like super minimal. And as far as like minimal ones that also actually had components mm-hmm. pre-built that you could use,
oh right,
it kind of fit the bill, and I went for it. And it didn't come bundled with jQuery, which is awesome because I was like, that's cool. I thought I might use Vue or something, mm-hmm. but I ended up just having like one little piece of place where I need to do some Ajax. And so I'm just like, fuck it, I'm just gonna write Ajax and. Vanilla JavaScript.
So you thought.
Yeah. And then I got in there and I was like, I'm a crippled person. Right. I can't, where's my dollar signs? And I was looking at like every, I just felt so totally incompetent and incapable. Like,
oh yeah.
How did I do this? How do I look up? So the answer is I didn't. Like at the point that I started doing dynamic front ends, it was like either MooTools or MooTools and then jQuery.
Yeah. jQuery is definitely... it's funny when you think what you realize is when you think of vanilla JavaScript, a lot of that is jQuery, and you just hadn't realized that it was jQuery.
Until you go to do stuff,
and you're just like, oh wait, that's not something I get with JavaScript. That's a jQuery thing.
Yeah, and like it's not too bad these days because all browsers have the like. Get element by selector or whatever.
Yeah, it's
well,
nice now.
There's one that's just like selector, and then you can do just like you would with jQuery. Give it, mm-hmm. you know, pound for an ID, mm-hmm. dot for a class. You can do attribute names using brackets and stuff like that. So that's all there. The only thing that you have to keep in mind is it always returns an array. And so
it's not an actual array.
Yeah. And so if you're looking up one thing by ID, you have to, you're in this world of just like, you know, do a lookup.
Open
item zero. Yeah, which just kills me. We were doing some Python code that looked like that the other day, Alan. We were trying to find every way on Earth.
You've got
to
talk about that madness.
Ugh.
The overwritten query.
Yeah, yeah.
Without going into detail about from where it surfaced.
Yeah, it's, yeah. Alan, you can talk about it. You're closer to it.
Oh, I shudder. what is that thing? It's Django translatable models.
Yeah, I don't remember. It's a module that's used apparently in lots of other third party. It was a dependency on an e-commerce framework that we were using. And it's just like, so to give Blake, to give you some context, by the way, Blake Johnson's back with us this episode, the world's longest intro ever. But I don't actually feel that strong of an obligation to introduce you now that you're basically just a rotating co-host.
Right. This is number three. I think it's official.
And two in a row. Right.
Right.
Basically it overrides something so fundamental to the Django framework that you would never expect to have gotten something unexpected there. So at the ORM level in Django, anytime you make a query, you get back an object, which is called a query set object. Mm-hmm. It is just an abstraction layer around the results from whatever database backend that you're using. And it's got this very standardized API that the entirety of Django as a framework depends on.
Okay.
Django has its own admin system that can work with your database without you describing anything because it expects to be working with models and query sets. So like we were having this really weird, strange results, like unexpected stuff from a database query, right?
Yeah. So it was, so you do like a get query and that's supposed to, you know, return back one of those abstract wrappers right around the object.
A query set. Well, no, actually it's actually supposed to just return an object is what a get does.
The filter returns the query set.
Yeah. Right?
And so with this translation in there, it kept returning. It was like expected one, got two.
Yeah.
So I'm like, well, that's weird. Maybe I got some dirty data in the database. And I go and look. Nope. there's only one. Ugh. And then, yeah. And so, and it, but then I run the query in the shell and I get the same error. So I'm like, okay, well, I mean, there's some consistency here. So I haven't gone mad yet. And so what it was, the translations is basically, it's like,
I don't even know how they've done it, like, mechanically. Exactly. I kind of want to look at the source code.
Yeah, I was thinking, I hadn't figured out how they had done it.
It's like a joiner table in between. And so what it was doing, it was doing
clever.
It was doing the lookup and returning two instances.
It was duplicate.
Of the same record.
Yeah, there was a single record, and it was returning duplicate instances of it, like you might get in a SQL query.
Yeah, with the thing that blew me away. Sorry, I was Googling something that I'll share in a moment. Mm. The thing that blew me away was you said, look and see if they have the same primary key.
Yeah.
And I was just like, that's not possible. We live in a world with order. Yeah. And then he was like, yep,
how same can a primary key return and two I objects went, with the
nope,
same
nope, I'm done. There's no logic in the world anymore.
And I was like, how
all
is that even?
President Trump.
Yeah, like fundamentally, how is that even possible within Django? Like I can get how...
Exactly.
I
within
can,
any database.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But different tables.
Yeah. It was, with the join table, right? You might have multiple instances for it. But yeah, anyway, so... When we got to looking, it's still like the way the query was written in Django's ORM, it still didn't make sense. We were like trying to return the distinct version of it. So you can, just like you can do a select distinct in SQL, there's a distinct modifier on a query set, and we still got two objects. And I was like, what the fuck's happening now? That makes no sense. And then we checked the type that was being returned by the query, which was fundamentally just like, why are we even doing it? Why would we ever do it? Why would I check the type of a thing that I know exactly what it's going to be? And it came back and it was some subclass of the actual thing in Django that this model, this library had injected. And that was infuriating because.
So you stopped using that library, right?
Yeah, we're stuck.
Wish I could. Okay. Some technical debt there. Okay,
because it's a dependency on a third party framework that we're pretty heavily, sunken cost at the very least at this point. And it's like built into every single model in the data model. Okay. This thing is just, it's bolted onto it, which
everything
is a bummer.
Everything is translatable.
It's a little bit better now that we know it's there and like we can predict it. And we found a solution for it that involved.
That looks so ugly though.
Item sub zero from the array, but like.
Item sub zero from the array and then dot ID so I can get the primary key off of it. It's awful looking.
Code perspective, anyone who doesn't do that, we should leave some descriptive comments there.
For sure. Because
someone's going to find that later and be like, what were these dipshits doing?
How high was this guy?
Yeah. And then they're going to spend 2.5 hours like we did trying to they're gonna fix it. And then CI is going to blow up. And they're like, well, it couldn't be what I did. What I did was so fundamental to the framework, that's not even worth considering. And then thus the cycle continues of the thought process that we had.
So I haven't actually run into this personally, but in JavaScript, it's so easy to just overwrite or add methods to like the prototype of object or an array or something. And I've read about like that causing issues in with like some libraries and stuff. So it'll just extend it.
Yeah.
It'll add things to it and you try and get something or whatever and it manipulates it somehow before you get it.
Which is weird. Yeah, that's weird because that's kind of what this is doing. I'm not exactly sure by what Pythonic mechanism they're doing it. Because in that world, you can basically inject...
It's so easy.
You can inject logic like up the method resolution order on some parent object.
Yep.
And have it cascade down.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whereas like that's not... I mean, you can import something and kind of monkey patch it if you do it in the right way. Like in Django's settings file, something that executes before the rest of your code. But like... This is not doing it that way. This is like some mix in on a model that is somehow mixed in at the bottom most implementation of that class that's modifying behavior at something like way up in the Django core framework.
But, you know, I mean, and that's why a lot of people will gripe about, you know, multi-inheritance too.
Yeah. Because of like those kind of risks.
Yeah.
But it's also just like, I think that's irresponsible design. That like, to do something so utterly unpredictable and against what is clearly the flow of a framework is like, that's just like, people are going to trip over that all day, every day. You should know that.
Well, it's in my opinion, it would be the responsibility of the original,
developer
for that library to put it in the README. Like, these are the things we've monkey patched or overwritten. So it's really clear. And then anybody who implements that needs to also like pay it forward to be like, hey, by the way, we use this library.
It's like the GPL license, but if you, for shitty code warning.
But if you open source it, like if you do it internal, hey, that's on you. Tell your coworkers that you've just ruined their day or like month, whatever. But like if you're going to implement it and then make your code either commercially available and documented so that they have the source or open source, you've got to say, oh, by the way, we have this thing and it does that. Because that reminds me of, well, in a different way, and this is something that we've probably run into using Expo. So for building React Native apps and you use Expo, when you go to submit to the Apple store, there's a thing that says, you know, do you use anything that works with ads or this or that? I forget the exact terminology, but basically it's saying, you doing anything with ads or anything to kind of pay attention to what your people are doing for ad's sake? And you're like, no, I don't do anything like that in my app. And you click no. And then the app store goes, yeah, you do. What are you thinking? I saw that. I saw. Yeah. Why are you lying to me?
Yeah.
And you're like, what are you talking about?
Jesse ran into that the other day.
Yeah. And so you're like, what? And you do some research. And it turns out Expo uses another library that uses something in there that allows...
Some usage tracking or something.
I think it's something to do with the debugging. But it is, in a sense, usage tracking.
Right.
But if you look at that library's site, they tell you, oh, by the way, when Apple says this, just click this and this and say okay, and they're fine with it. But it's like... Why didn't Expo tell me that? Like, did I have to go Google this in a panic going, what
is this? It's a great idea. I'm going to invent the shitty code public license, I like V3, the shit PL. And the way the shit PL works is you have to define all the places where you did really terrible things in the code. Yeah. And if you you can redistribute this code, you can derive new code from it, but you do have to, you adhere to these terms and you must distribute it with a copy of this shit PL license that tells everyone where all the crap is.
And you're like, these are the terrible things that you've inherited and we're sorry. Timelines. Gonna be timelines,
and it'll be like the shit. It'll be more like the GPL V2, where it's like very like, even if it's linked, even if it's like sitting just on a drive next to your code, you still have to distribute. Yeah. Like,
by the way, I was Googling. I thought that we needed to describe Blake as our like the token liberal for Fox News, as our token JavaScript developer. Oh. So I was like, who's the token liberal on Fox News? Because I don't watch a lot of Fox News, so I had to Google. Apparently it's Alan Combs.
Alan Combs,
From Andy Alan Combs.
So you're the Alan Combs of Friday Afternoon.
I was just thinking of like Crossfire, you know?
Exactly. So,
amazing.
Hey, Blake, everything you think is wrong. What do you think about this? That's my Crossfire impression. What do you think?
Perfect.
I can work for Fox News.
Spot on.
Perfect.
If you haven't seen
Mr. Murdoch, give me a call.
If you haven't seen the video where Jon Stewart ended up on Crossfire,
it's
and calls them
beautiful.
Out for just being.
I haven't seen this.
He basically performs like a sit-in on their show for half an hour.
He's like, why are you guys doing this?
You should be ashamed of yourselves.
Like, you should be ashamed that you're just performatively talking about politics. And they're like, what are you talking about? You do silly stuff all the time. He's like, I'm on Comedy
Central. I'm on the Comedy Channel.
I'm followed by a show that's crank calls done by puppets. People think you're actual news, though. This is a terrible thing that you're doing.
It's pretty.
And they
it's
keep pretty beautiful. Like, why aren't you being funny? He's just like, because I'm not on Comedy Central right now.
I'm on the news.
Man, I haven't seen that. I love Jon Stewart.
We'll add it to the show notes.
Hey, so long. We took a long time to get there, but we do have a topic for today. Totally not relevant to anything we've talked about so far, except maybe warnings about shitty code lurking.
Sure.
But yeah, Blake, we were going to talk a little bit about kind of hiring entry level junior developers and maybe more than hiring, like grooming, training, all that sort
of
stuff.
Yeah, just kind of in general. So obviously I think there are a ton of developer jobs out there, but I think if you look around, most of them are like, we all want senior developers.
Mid to senior, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. And there are a shortage of them. And for someone, when I was teaching at the global campus, that was a big concern of all the students, is how do you kind of get your foot in the door? Because there are not a lot of junior level positions. And just as an example, at RevUnit, we might have one every 6 months.
Right.
And so I just wanted to kind of talk about that. Like, how do you guys handle it? how do you, what should people that are trying to break into the industry or trying to get their first dev job, what kinds of things do you guys think they should do to make, to increase their chances, et cetera?
Totally. I mean, I can start off with like the answer to the first one. What do we do? Mm-hmm. And the answer is not enough. And that's something that's kind of, we talk about it a lot internally, something we've identified and known for a long time. Part of it is it's a consequence of our business model. Mm-hmm. Because we're not working on our own products. And so, right. It's difficult for us to make the investment in entry-level talent because it's not just the investment of their salary. It's also the opportunity cost because they're not ready to be billed out to our customers where we're positioning ourselves as selling expert mm-hmm. talent, right? So, and then there's also like people pairing with them and it creates other types of not friction in a negative way, but it's in some difficult to measure way, some drag is created on a team. Again, not in a negative way, but when you're in the business of selling people's time by the hour, that actually has a direct impact on the top line of the business. Not even it's not a bottom line discussion for us. It's actually a top line. It's a revenue problem. And so we've gotten creative though. In 4 years, we're still a small company. We're not near the size that you guys are. We've had two entry-level positions. Mm-hmm. One of them was the first hire I made. And so it was just like, it was the only path was like, I can only afford entry-level talent. Right. So I'm going to find a good person with like really solid aptitude that had a little bit of like hobbyist experience, mm-hmm. And just like focused really hard on graduating that person up as we grew the firm. And the other one was Alan. So I thought Alan would bring really good perspective here. Alan's coming up on 2 years with us at Lofty. He's not in our entry level position anymore. He's full blown software engineer, which is awesome. And so
I think so.
I think that you can speak maybe a little bit about what you did to get ready here. You're the closest from that side of the perspective.
One of the things, and I know, like, so I talk to people, you know, fairly often that they're trying to break into the biz, so to speak. And,
hey, the biz.
Yeah. And, you know, I always see them kind of go, but I'm like, dude, meetups, like, come to the meetups, step one. Yeah. Like, get to know all the people out there and, you know, and kind of get to speak the language, especially if you're a hobbyist, like, you know, that's a great way to kind of get to connect and learn new things and learn what's actually applicable and what you should be learning and stuff like that.
Yeah,
and
like what's relevant? What are people working on?
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And also you make connections that way, right? That's key, you know.
Spoiler alert, the two juniors that I hired both came out of the Python meetup group that I also run.
So. Spoiler alert, that's also how I got my job.
Yeah, see? So
spoiler alert, when I was hiring folks, I did it through meetups and local tech conferences.
Spoiler alert, none of these are actually spoilers.
I think it's just right on topic.
Yeah.
So kind of to back up just a second, do you guys, and you don't have to answer this if you don't want to, Casey, but do you guys, when you bill out to customers, is it a tiered rate or is it based on the people working on it or is it a flat rate?
We have changed our billing model relatively recently in which we are now billing different rates for different people. Mm-hmm. Prior to that, what we did was a blended rate. So honestly, our...
like an average or...
Yeah, basically we had a set rate mm-hmm. basically for all of our time. Internally, we accounted for that as sort of an average. So if we looked at it internally based on where the people in their positions were from on a cost basis, we're looking at how much we're paying people, right? Mm-hmm. We could see how like over or under leveraged we're. Like our bill rate is blah, but like we've got all senior people on it. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the margin on it is less than a project where we have a better blend of people. So we were trying to get an average, but... that made it tricky to make every project profitable mm-hmm. and still staff it the right way.
Right.
It gave us incentive to be like, this is a really complicated project that will be very profitable for us if we put like two non-seniors on it.
Right.
And we just didn't want to be in a position to ever want to do that and be incentivized to do it or obligated to do it. And so by setting rates per people, we're now in a more prescriptive approach. And we say, hey, this is the team that you need. This is the cost that it is. And we arrive at that cost based on the different roles that are there.
Okay.
So for the right kind of project, we're not obligated to staff it with all senior talent.
Okay.
Also, we don't get into a situation where like we would ever put a junior alone on a project, mm-hmm. right?
Sure.
Because we have a cost mechanism in place that if we have one junior on a project, the client can afford for us to also put a senior with it. So
right,
yep. it's worked a lot better. Our blended rate worked differently when we were small. Mm-hmm. As we've grown, like we just needed different knobs and levers.
Okay. Yeah. So I think that's valuable context, though.
Yeah.
So at RevUnit, also for context, it's a tiered approach as well.
Right.
And so I do think that adds a little bit more flexibility when you're trying to put different levels of people on the project.
It does for us now. This is, like I said, a relatively new thing. It does make things better, right? Because what I'm not doing is basically saying, like, you now, from on a financial basis, like optically to my customer based on what they're paying,
right,
you don't have the obligation to perform at the same level.
Yeah, right.
Because you're not being billed out at the same level.
Right.
That's really good, you know.
So, I guess, Alan, what kinds of things, how did you try and make yourself stand out then to, I guess, get the opportunity? Cause I think that's a big part of it. If I think about the global campus stuff, I think we had in the first cohort or whatever, we had 10 students that finished or something like that. And right off the bat, I think two of them got jobs, and then we've had several, since that I got jobs, but for one of them in particular, who was a very, very good student, it took him like 2 years to get in. So what kinds of things do you think that you did to sort of set yourself up for success?
I came out of NTI and I took night classes there, and that was a big part of it is I pushed myself for like a couple of years of just, like, I know I kind of need to go above my comfort zone, basically, and just try to soak up all kinds of information that I can. And the classes helped a lot with learning a lot of good fundamentals because mostly I'm self-taught. Mm-hmm. But it's really easy to follow a tutorial and then go, oh, cool, well, I built a blog site or something. But understanding object-oriented programming and things like that, some of the fundamentals really helped. But it wasn't immediate too. It was maybe a year, maybe two. Mm-hmm. One of the things is, I know it's easy to get discouraged too and to think like, well, maybe it's not for me. But I just, stay persistent and kept coming to the meetups. And it was kind of funny because, like, before I would come to it, I'd be debating, should I, and then when I did, I felt good because it's also like you're having fellowship with people that are into the same thing. Other than that, just every spare moment, like I would be working on stuff and I'd always be showing Casey like, oh, look at this thing I did. This is going to like help me store D&D characters for my D&D group,
Right.
But just showing, demonstrating to him that I could do the things, but also, I was telling my wife this the other day that like one of my biggest discouragements maybe early on was like I had no way to gauge my ability that I did have.
Right. Yeah.
Because
you have no benchmark.
Yeah, right, exactly. So I'm like, well, yeah, I know the things. I can build a blog, but like, but then you kind of start talking to other people and you're like, oh, well, yeah, I mean, maybe I could do this too.
Right. Yeah. Slowly, like the things coming out of their mouth stop sounding like Greek and you're like,
exactly.
Oh, yeah,
I get it.
Oh, yeah. I know what you're talking about. Yeah. 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 And here at Lofty, like the path I took at the time, we had an SRE position. And so I've had a lot of network and kind of sysadmin stuff, experience, networking, setting up servers like in racks and stuff, old school stuff. And so I know my way around, a Linux server, which was pretty big for us, being a small team, especially at that time.
Yeah.
I feel like that helped me to provide value right away. While I got to work closely with other developers and learn much more about the coding side of everything.
Yeah, because at the time we didn't have our billing structured where there was a place to necessarily bill Allen out at a full rate. What we did have were support contracts for apps that we had already launched that we were maintaining. And so that was our SRE position, site reliability engineer, which is a position that still exists here, but it's not a chair that is obligated to be filled. So it's an option for us to basically put someone in a place where they can support some of our applications from like a, you know, like disaster recovery standpoint. If you know your way around, you know, a Linux command line and system services, we can like get someone leveled up there pretty quickly. And yeah, super, super valuable, right, to be able to do that, to not pull people off of billable work to go stand up the server that fell over.
Right.
And that was also a mechanism by which we could pay for it, right? And then, like, you're helping support the apps that we're working on from an infrastructure perspective. Ah, you found a bug. Cool. Here's how I'll fix it. Help me deploy it.
Right.
Then the next time it's like, hey, I found a bug, but I saw how you did it last time. I'm going to get in there and fix the bug. Right. And now you're doing that junior level dev work where you're fixing bugs and defects and stuff like that. And that very quickly kind of snowballed for Allen to, you know, just coming in and working on projects and writing code and leading projects, you know.
Yeah.
So that was a mechanism that worked well for us.
Yeah. We have a lot of juniors that interview at RevUnit, and a couple trends that I've noticed. A lot of juniors do the same tutorials.
Mm. Oh yeah.
And we'll put them on GitHub. So it doesn't. It's fine to do them, but I feel like if you understand what the tutorial is trying to teach you and you can take it a little bit further, that kind of does stand to set you apart a little
bit. Totally. Because you see a lot of to-do lists out there. But D&D example is a really good one because I can look at that and go, not only do you understand what you're doing, but you understand how to apply the technique to an existing problem.
Specific problem that's, I had, right?
Yeah. That's super valuable to consulting.
That's one thing that I was going to say was that with folks that I would like see and recognize and be like, there's someone that I want to bring into a team and develop, is like it becomes more of a hobby than a professional pursuit.
Right.
Because when you have a hobby, you're looking to see what you can do with it. And so rather than just doing tutorials, you find a problem that you have for yourself, regardless of how minuscule that problem is, like keeping track of the mileage on your vehicle or something like that.
This is my toy project.
His toy project. But at that point, you're going through the entire process of, this is my problem. This is how I will use technology to solve it.
Right.
And I've built this and deployed it.
Right.
That is far more significant than I did this tutorial and committed it to GitHub. And everybody's got little tedious problems.
Totally,
everybody's got something that they wish existed.
Everyone has a wish list.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't matter if you like get traction or get like organic users in that, like we talked about, I think it was last week even.
Yeah.
Like it's just a matter of, I found a way to use my knowledge of programming to
exercise
solve a problem
my skill
that was real to me. And to me, that is a huge indicator of like initiative and drive and critical thinking to show like this is how I'll fix this and this is how this all works out. And so that goes a long way beyond having a ton of the like basic tutorials kind of in your profile. One thing I wanted to ask you was, you said that you had one student who was an excellent student that went, I think you said 2 years before they got a job?
Right.
How do you define excellent student in that context? Like, what made him an excellent student?
Basically the stuff that we've been talking about. So this guy, for his like final project, and it was a 6-month course, basically built his own version of Spotify, which meant he had to learn how you send music. Like, and none of this
stream
was in a stream. Yeah. Like, none of this was included in the class. He just like figured it out.
Yeah.
And then he went from the back end course where he was just kind of like playing with it, and the front end was pretty, you know, like definitely rudimentary at that point. But then he took, then he went and spent another 6 months taking like the mobile course and turned it into like a mobile app with Ionic. And then he rewrote it again in React Native, just to learn, like, to keep.
That's very
pretty good.
And he, he's good.
Because like
he just caught on to stuff very quickly.
That's awesome. As an employer and as you know, like the leader of a dev team, I will take a tinkerer, like an interested tinkerer over someone that like will diligently complete their homework any day.
Yeah, right.
Like exactly. The ability to knock things off a task list, while valuable, is. That's a lot easier to teach, right? It's a lot easier to teach someone to manage their time and complete things than it is to teach someone passion.
Yeah, you know
what I mean?
Yeah, that's a big part of it. I remember while you were saying that, one of the things that I think set me apart pretty quickly with my instructor really kind of pushing me in that direction and me being like, man, are you sure? Like, you know, I'm in a networking course and, you know, I don't know if I can do it.
Networking like, courses where all good developers go. I had to save a high school kid. He's just like, I'm going to go get my,
I don't know if I'm going to write code. I'm going to get a Cisco certification.
OSI certified? Is it the layers?
I think it's the OSI layers.
OSI.
I was just like, no, don't. But there's not, there may or may not be a certification for that, but it's like, yeah, don't do that. Write code. And he's just like, no, I'm going to be a networker. So dude, stop. And finally, he's just like, Python's pretty neat. I was like, my God. No offense to people pulling cable. We appreciate you, nonetheless.
We need you.
Yeah.
But so we had a few rudimentary projects that we did, though, in software analysis and design was the name of the class. And so I actually was able to complete things pretty quickly. We were using Visual Basic at the time. And so I would get stuff done, and then I would see my classmates struggling, and I would help them because I would also see the instructor struggling to help everyone figure out a for loop. And I'm all like, no, put that inside the loop. No, take that out of the loop. That's an infinite loop. That's never gonna stop. Yeah. And so then, like, when I wasn't doing that, then I would be writing it in every language, like whatever rudimentary command line tool we had built to, you know, look at a database or something. I would be writing it in Java and C# and JavaScript and Python, all of them. Yeah.
So the another thing that I think is really important, and something that I do feel like gets overlooked a lot, is we were talking about meetups earlier, but it's really easy to fall into the trap of, well, there's not a JavaScript meetup near me, or there's not a Python meetup near me. It doesn't matter. Go to any meetup.
Meetup. Especially because that mentality is so real. And with perspective from the inside, I always look at it and go like, why? Because if you're not in the field yet, but someone's already convinced you that there's one and only one language that's worth going and learning.
Right.
Yeah. Like, bad news. This industry's full of them, but that guy's full of shit, right?
Yeah.
Like, there's a whole lot of options, or girl, is like full of shit that you know, like, oh, you need to go learn JavaScript.
Yeah.
I see it on like Reddit and developer subreddits all the time. What language should I learn?
Right,
and then the flame war ensues. And I'm like,
so as a new developer, I think that's really overwhelming, honestly, because are so many choices.
They don't have the perspective, though, to understand that there is no correct answer to that question.
Right.
Exactly.
And, and it's just like, choose one and stick with it, because what'll happen a lot is they'll spend a couple weeks on one and then jump to another one because that's the flavor of the month or whatever. But like, just stick with one.
I started in PHP. I would never recommend PHP as a language to anyone.
Right, yeah.
But if I had started with something else, I don't know if I would have thought through. I got shit done in PHP.
Right. But the thing is, like, after you have your first one under your belt, like, all of the paradigms transfer to the next language.
Sure. Syntax is a superficial layer on top of that.
Well, right. And I would say, to your point about like, if you don't have a Python or JavaScript meetup group in your area, honestly, odds are that the economy in your area doesn't have a lot of job. Like, the meetup groups will kind of gravitate towards where the work is.
Right.
So if you don't have a JavaScript meetup group in your area, guess what? You don't have a lot of JavaScript developers in your area.
Yeah.
Probably not a lot of JavaScript jobs in your area either, right?
Exactly.
Well, of course,
not necessarily.
So when I started the JavaScript group, there was one other JavaScript group.
Don't go combs on me.
And it don't was. Do it. And, God damn it. There was one other group, and like 2 months after I started my JavaScript group, the other one just like stopped meeting, and for 3 years now I've been the only one. And but before that there wasn't one. Like, and there are lots of JavaScript jobs here.
That's totally true.
You know, like at some point maybe someone just hasn't had the like. Hasn't done it yet, so yeah. Maybe you should be the one that does it
as the organizer of a meetup group. Not to discourage you from doing it if there's not one, and you should go do it. But it is more a work. Pain in the ass.
It's more work than you think it's going to be. But it's also
lining up content
it.
Is hard, but like it's really good for the community.
Mm-hmm. And you like I think you could probably speak to this too, because when you start a group, you then become a connector in the community.
Yeah,
like people
absolutely.
Come
people
to
just
you.
Come to you. Yeah. Yeah.
And that was something I didn't really honestly expect, but that is what happens. And the first meetup I ever went to was your Python meetup, actually.
You were really?
Yeah. And I to this day barely know any Python. So
yeah.
It was, but I'm very much, and this may be unpopular, I'm still very much a firm believer in it's who you know, not what you know.
For sure. Yeah.
Like knowing people and making connections like in real life. is the most important thing for getting
a job. I agree with that, and I think it's really important. I always like to, I believe in that phrase as well, but I always also like to point out that like that phrase can be delivered in a snarky way.
Sure.
You know what I mean? In like a bitter way, but legitimately in a positive way, like making connections with people makes the world go round. And I don't mean that from a, you know, you got to have connections in high places kind of perspective and the way that phrase is used. But it really is about who you know.
The first, and it's more of being like top of mind, right? So like when someone
it's
has something
you,
come
it's who
up.
You know, and that is completely within your control.
Yeah.
Knowing more people
sure.
within your control. Right?
Yeah, right. Just, you know, and I think there's a lot of fear as well for people walking
totally.
Into these groups that don't know anything.
Yeah, it's
but
intimidating.
Like,
got
it's
news
intimidating.
For you. I've been writing code for 15 years. I still don't know jack shit.
Yeah, right? Like,
yeah.
And people, I think, you know, pretty much most developers are very welcoming. Like the community in general is very welcoming.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what language or whatever. You know, there's comments back and forth, like use this language, that language sucks or whatever. But at the end of the day, we're all developers. And,
right.
Yeah. It can be kind of like sports teams, but we all love football or.
Exactly.
Whatever.
Yeah. For sure.
Well said.
For sure.
I think one thing I can kind of give perspective to, I don't know what kind of jobs the individual you were talking about, that went 2 years without finding one was pursuing. But, we've kind of talked about with the two companies represented in here being consultancies/agencies, they will skew toward more mid-level, senior-level work.
Right.
Whereas if you're on a product company, and that's primarily, I worked for project companies before coming here, they are more open to hiring junior-level talent because they can do that. Like their income comes from a different thing. As long as the machine is still printing money, it doesn't matter if you've got a junior or an intern
There's
or apprentice pinned to somebody and pair programming with them. So, I mean, I came in as a junior at a product company and then took on another junior role and then went to a senior position where I was moved up to a place where I was like hiring and building a team. And that was on a product company, and I was able to pull people in because we had that flexibility and I had the freedom to identify talent that I wanted to develop to help me on that product. And then even with the last company I was with before here, we would bring in interns and we would train up those interns. It was paid internships because we wanted to provide that and the product itself was doing well. And so we had the freedom to bring in interns or what some people might call an apprentice, but these were interns through the university even.
Right.
To get them real world experience. And the whole time we're in there being like, why don't you just drop out of school and come work for us? We're trying to convince these guys not to get degrees. But I would argue that I would not argue, but rather I would advise for those pursuing work at the junior level, entry level stuff, try and build relationships and connections and connect with people in product companies because they'll generally have the ability to invest better into people and bring them up. Whereas if you're wanting to get into an agency shop or a consultancy, They because of things like billing and things of this nature,
right?
It'll be a little more constrictive, and so that and honestly, the environment within a product company, you're getting legacy code. Getting legacy code is a great way to learn because you're going to spend so much time reading code.
Yeah, the obligation isn't necessarily to create something from scratch, but rather maintain something that exists, which is a much more manageable workload when you're learning.
Generally, it's going to be like, here's this monolith. Learn how it works and make it do this one thing a little bit better.
Yeah, everything works except this one thing.
Exactly. Go find that one thing and fix that bug. And that's manageable, and it teaches you how to read code. You spend so much time reading code. I mean, we all know that. It's like you spend way more of your time reading code than you ever expected to, and probably more than you write. Being able to have the skill to read the code, learn how, you're going to learn so much better on the job having a monolith than somebody saying, oh, yeah, this client A needs this new thing. And you're just like, well, I blogged a blog before.
Need a blog?
How do I turn a blog into a Spotify? Yeah. Like, you don't want that kind of pressure. And,
right.
Yeah. And you know, presumably, whomever hired you wouldn't put you in that situation, but
they do. We don't.
Right.
I hope,
I'm sure some places might. But having the ability to step into a place with an established code base, with established functionality and systems that allow you to step in and learn stuff and read and build and then grow, and that will help you as an entry level developer coming in as apprentice or intern or junior or whatever that the case may be for that. So,
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, I have, I don't know if you guys have turned around, but there's a blizzard happening.
Yeah, it looks like
I was having to text my wife. No, I promise I'll make it home.
So maybe before we wrap up this episode, I have kind of one last thought to bat around and see if you guys agree. But I personally, one thing I really dislike about the entry level portion of this industry is actually the term junior. I personally think we should abolish it. I've said it several times today, but I don't know if you guys
agree.
What
do you think they should be called?
Apprentice or
apprentice developer?
Yeah, or
is that because junior has like
journeyman
a negative connotation?
Yeah, I think it has a negative connotation. Okay. I think that like sitting someone down in front of a client and saying, this is our junior developer is, you know, in a way, I mean, it's quite literally,
pejorative.
Yeah, it's quite literally belittling.
Yeah.
In the same way that like, I mean, maybe to balance that, senior is something to drop as well. I mean, we don't have junior as a title anymore here.
Okay.
When we first started hiring, my first person on that side of the skill set was hired as, we actually didn't have developers a title. We were titled as consultant. So I had junior consultant. And then as we grew, someone that I hired more on the senior side kind of pointed that out to me, and I agreed. And we kind of retitled everything. For us, the entry level position for us as a company became that site reliability engineer position, which had, you know, no mention of skill set in it. But yeah, I think that makes it a little bit, maybe within a larger organization, even worse, like from a culture perspective of like, he's a junior.
Right.
It's this sort of dismissive othering of like, oh yeah, let the juniors work on it. You know, yeah, I think it is to a certain extent pejorative.
I can see where you're coming from. Absolutely. I guess from my perspective, I still kind of think it's okay. Cause I haven't necessarily heard something that I think is better. Like journeyman would probably be okay. Or like apprentice would probably be okay. But,
I mean, a lot of people adopt like the
journeyman's, like senior engineer.
Is it?
Yeah.
In a trade?
I was an apprentice fire sprinkler, installer for a while.
Yeah,
okay.
I was working my way up to
journeyman.
Okay. Yeah,
that's what I was going to say was I often compare, So we like to think of ourselves as engineers, and in a sense we are, but also we're basically like data plumbers.
We're way closer to industrial mechanics than we are mechanical engineers.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Well said. And so I've often thought of kind of like the analogy of like, and I think that in the same way that having an academic background, like I have a CS degree, is like, that's awesome, but you don't know 3/4 of what you need to know to apply that in the real world.
Right.
And so you have to go through a process of learning on the job training and learning application of the knowledge that you have. You have you have a knowledge of like the fundamentals of everything, and that's valuable, but the application of that is very different. And so you have to go through that process. And so it's very comparable to the trades in that regard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's an inherent need for that. And so looking at titles that kind of mirror that, I mean, I don't remember. You've got like Master Electrician.
I was going to say, is it Apprentice, Journeyman, Master? Is that the level in the trades?
Yeah.
Because that sounds fucking sweet. I'm a Master Developer.
Yeah.
Sounds pretty badass. Like I go home and put on my Master Developer belt and like fucking kick boards and break them and stuff. Like, that sounds cool.
I was imagining like an Obi-Wan robe or something.
Dawn Master Developer.
Yeah. I'm a ninth degree Master Engineer.
Yeah, there it is.
I don't know. I don't have the perfect answer for it. I just think that, and this isn't,
it's evolving, you know,
and it's not, it's totally not, you know, this field did not invent that titling structure. This exists in the consulting and management consulting and business and finance. You have junior analysts and so on and so forth. Actually, that's a really good one, by the way. Developer analyst is one that we're entertaining over here for, entry-level positions. Developer analyst, software developer, senior developer.
Okay. There's a company, one of my buddies that used to live here, moved to Chicago and now works for a company called, I can't remember the name.
Eighth Light.
That's it.
Are you talking about?
About coffee.
Yeah. Talk about McCormick.
They
do this thing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. They
he has to apprentice, even though he was like, he was a master developer, and he still had to apprentice.
Yeah. So their job titles are software crafter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they get into the craftsmanship thing, and I won't besmudge that.
They have
apprentice, they have software crafter, things of that nature.
Yeah,
I can get behind it. As cheesy as it may sound, comparative to the rest of the industry, which kind of has some norms. There's also like the federal government military style, which is like engineer one, engineer two, three. Yeah, and like I don't love that, but. It conveys seniority without applying, you know, like subjective adverb or adjectives to it, you know?
Yeah, I can totally get behind that. I think as an industry though, like I don't see that changing anytime
soon. No, I mean, it's a huge boulder to push uphill, and it's, you know, of all of my social causes, it's probably not of all the ones I preach, but you know, it's not the worst one, but I think it's one that, you know, it's one that's easy to fix though.
Right.
Like when you're setting up an organization, when you're starting up a tech group or something like that, it's very easy to decide and say, hey, we're going to call that apprentice or we're going to call it analyst or whatever it is.
So, sorry, I just pulled up their list of jobs. Crafter, lead crafter, principal crafter, consulting crafter, technical expert, director.
Huh. Excellent. Wow.
There's a lot of levels.
That's a depth
in there.
Chart. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a big group.
But yeah, it's an interesting concept. And like, I can get behind that. Like, I understand how people could feel sort of besmirched or whatever.
It's fun to pick at it from a distance, but the developers that I know, they really, really are into it. There's a couple guys from a former company here that made their way up there, and they really like the culture there. And,
oh, at Eighth Light. Yeah. I've heard it's amazing.
So, yeah, it's easy to be like, oh, crafter.
No. I've heard that it's.
That's not the worst.
I've heard nothing but great things about the company itself.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've heard far worse bullshit titles in the startup world.
Rockstar Dev 1.
Oh, or just like
Rockstar
someone.
Rockstar Pony Dev 2.
Someone that like comes and unlocks the doors and stands in the lobby for 2 hours a day being like. Director of first impressions or some shit like that.
Rockstar Unicorn Dev. Uh-huh. 5.
So one of the most ridiculous examples of that was I worked for a company that we did work with Zappos. And Zappos is a flat company, and they decided we don't want job titles anymore. Like they used Holdocracy as their model. And if you want to jump down that rabbit hole of weird bureaucracy of business, you can do that. But they were like, job titles are oppressive. We're not going to do job titles. You call yourself whatever you want. And so everybody's just like, I'm the customer service cowboy, and I'm the HR unicorn.
I know where all the engine yard pandas went to.
Yeah, yeah. No. I love my pandas. You can't have the pandas.
Zappos is one of our customers, so I can't say anything.
Mm. But
I'm contractually obligated to remain silent.
What was funny though was in the midst of all of that, they like it became such a shtick of going through there was a culture outlaw, and it was everybody kind of did their like they introduced themselves, and because we went through when we first started meeting with them and going through that whole process, we went through like one of the kind of corporate-y tours, and all the culture people walked up and like gave their introductions of themselves, and you could tell it was just like, this is just your like shtick, like your song and dance that you do.
Yeah.
And this is enforced, but you hate it just as much as if you were just called like HR Tech One.
Right.
And so it's like, yeah, you're a culture unicorn.
I still have to eat a shit sandwich every day for breakfast.
Exactly.
But at least I'm a code gunslinger.
That's,
you know?
Right. Yeah. That's exactly.
Like, exactly, like Bon Jovi said, only the names change.
Yeah. So I will say though that Zappos, the culture there is really good.
Is it pretty awesome?
Yeah, I've heard good things. It is, and the way that they try and run the company is super interesting, and we could talk about that some other time. But it's like it's pretty cool actually, the way that they sort of try to get people to improve the company, improve their section of the company. Like, there's a lot of freedom there, and. We actually had our all hands meeting on the Zappos campus last fall.
Oh, cool.
Nice. And so I got to talk to a couple of people who worked there, and the people I did talk to were super happy to be working there and satisfied. And
Wait, is Zappos in Vegas?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They're in the old City Hall. They took over.
Yeah.
That's part of the whole Tony Shea Downtown Vegas project.
It's cool. So while their titles may not be, or maybe interesting to read from afar, it is a pretty cool place to work.
Not the most interesting thing about their management structure. No. I do nerd out about management structure. Well, I mean, it's kind of cool.
Holacracy can't allows, be cool. Mm-hmm. Holacracy is basically democracy of organizational structure. Like it goes down to like lawyers and judges.
Okay.
Because you have your company's constitution.
Everyone has representation at the highest levels.
Right. And it's completely flat in that regard. But then the people who have power are the people who basically know the constitution well enough to act as judges, and the people who argue their points well enough to act as attorneys. And it takes on the shape of, and I'm not saying this is necessarily how this plays out at Zappos per se, but we worked with the behavioral scientist who was kind of studying Zappos as well. Like, he was one of the guys that we worked with there, and so he kind of observed it and had all this other insight, and it was interesting to see how it kind of all played out, because it did in some instances kind of turn into this like the teams that were created would always have somebody kind of playing those roles,
right.
So yeah, it's very different than a traditional, like he compared modern structures within companies as fiefdoms versus a democracy of a whole
like
thing.
I could actually talk about flat org structures for like an entire podcast.
We need to start org structure podcast,
because it's like Friday really interesting.
Just explore a different org structure every week.
I don't want to do that actually. I'm sorry.
I just like the idea that somewhere in there is someone's like the presiding judge of the Ninth Court of Appeals. Like when your idea didn't get past your first tier, I guess not manager, but your first tier judge. Like, is there an appeal process? I assume so, right?
I would assume so too. I don't know. I didn't study it that far.
Is there a pull request appeal process?
You know, that's the GitHub methodology, right? GitHub, and I think Thoughtbot has that. If you're familiar with Thoughtbot, they're another dev agency that kind of publishes their structure and playbook. One of them, almost certainly GitHub does it too, but basically has their employee manual is published as a GitHub repository written in Markdown. And so you can propose like changes to company structure by simply submitting a pull request against the company handbook. Like, you know, here's my PR that adds 15 holidays. And then like the merge master comes in. It's like, how the fuck will we ever make that work? Like, it's kind of a cool concept. We tried it for a little while. We had our company handbook in GitHub.
We did.
It's not there anymore.
No.
It didn't get much love though. So
yeah,
I was creating pull requests and reviewing myself like about half the projects that we were doing at the time. Well, cool. As the snow falls on Northwest Arkansas, which is somewhat rare, I guess we're going to call it the end of an episode. Everybody have a good weekend.
Yeah.
So we need to get out of here before we get stuck.
Before we get,
we live in a part of the real. Yeah, we live in a part of the world where an inch of snow.
I was going to say one thing to answer this question that I always get, like, and I used to ask from, you know, new developers, new people just, you know, interested in it. Which language should I learn?
JavaScript.
That's what Blake says.
Alan, keep it down.
No, I'm Combs. My point is that worked for Blake. So my answer is always, man, it's whichever one keeps you engaged, whichever one keeps you interested and doesn't discourage you. You know.
But not really.
No, you weren't kidding, Blake.
No, it's fine. It's amazing.
Yeah. We love you. We wouldn't have you on the show if it wasn't all right.
He's a host of the show now.
Yeah, exactly.
He's having us at this point.
We appreciate you having us again, Blake.
Yeah. Thanks for inviting us to our office.
My token Python developers.
Now you're hosting whatever the MSNBC equivalent is to Crossfire. Yeah.
He's the Rachel Maddow.
He's Rachel Maddow. Yeah.
Fuck yeah.
We'll see you in a week.
Thanks for listening to Friday Afternoon Deploy, recorded and produced by the team at Lofty Labs. If you enjoyed the show, you can subscribe to future episodes via iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Play, and Spotify. You can also follow at Friday Deploy on Facebook and Twitter for episode previews, live streams, and other behind-the-scenes peeks. Past episodes and show notes on this episode can be found at friday.hirelofty.com. That's friday.hirelofty.com. If you'd like to contact the show, or if you're local to the Northwest Arkansas area and would like to be a guest on the show, you can email us at podcast@hirelofty.com.